and the majority of this hour in the company of John Thurgood. Morning, John.
Good morning, all.
Made the trip down from Launceston this morning to join
us. Nice
yes,
smoothly.
Yes, good boy. And Thurgood's a surname that we've associated with retailing products around Tasmania for, a couple of generations now, I dare
say. Well, my father since the 50s.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And we probably all have an inkling of what you do and the things you've brought into the state, going back to Beta video recorders, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of the king of the Beta when everybody else was pushing the poorer version of the VHS.
Yeah, I think you backed the wrong horse there, though. Yeah.
Well, you know,
anyway,
it works better, you know.
It's ancient history. And very much behind the development of the heat pump as well, which is a purely Tasmanian term, isn't it? We call the reverse cycle air conditioner a heat pump.
Picked up on it. It's air source heat pump used in England now and so forth and around the world. But basically, even Dakin, I can't get them to change the word to use heat pump. They say that might confuse people, the national marketing manager said, because it's an air conditioner. If you ask anybody what an air conditioner is, worldwide, 99.9% will say it's for cooling.
Exactly. But in Tasmania, we use them for heating.
Stole it, the term heat pump, and got it to market and created that new category.
Yes, indeed. Now, lots of questions to be asked this morning, and we obviously always are keen to hear about the very latest when it comes to domestic systems. You know, we hear about this high-end technology with Elon Musk and all the stuff that he's doing, but we want to know about what we can put into our own home. So let's have your experiences on what has worked for you, but also your questions about what maybe you could install. Now, I've got a couple in the queue here, because I know you've got a guest that you'd like to have a quick word to, because there is something that's going to be game-changing. Is that sort of beating it up too much? Or
it's kind of taken like a Commodore 64 to a 100 years advanced version of Windows Millennium, because it hasn't been invented yet, all in one leap and bound.
So this is something that might change the way we're talking about battery storage here.
Correct.
Okay, well, let's just do these couple of texts because they got in very early. I'm having solar panels installed soon. We're high users of tariff 41 rather than 31.
Correct.
This does get a bit technical, but we just have to bear with that.
Tariff compared to the lights and power tariff. Hot water and heating is 17 cents, 17.2, and 26 cents for the lights and power.
Now, you need to choose which tariff to apply solar power generated. Although a lower rate, the mathematics seems to show we'd pay it off quicker applying to tariff 41. Any thoughts on that?
I'd like to run that through a spreadsheet. I've had, out of 1,100 odd systems, big and small, we've done, only one customer so far has hooked up half, so put up a 10 kilowatt system and 5 kilowatts on 41 and 5 kilowatts on 31.
So the majority have always gone to tariff 31 in that case with their solar generated power?
Yes. Now, if you're running heating, generally it's heat pumps, of course, these days, for the energy efficiency. Now, 90% of the load is when the sun's not shining. So you'll be feeding in heavily, and when you offset a little, you'll only be offsetting 17 cents, not 26. So the numbers would point towards getting a 9 cents credit and putting it all on 31 and or this new battery option.
Yeah, don't complicate matters. So they're just going to have them installed. Should they go for 41 or 31?
Well, they probably need to contact me and I'll run through the data from their bills and put it through the spreadsheet.
But your gut feeling is it's going to be 31?
99.9.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty good gut feeling, isn't it? All right. Morning, gentlemen. I want to get this in early. Honest opinion regarding small wind turbines, 200 to 600 watt units. I have a clear, unobstructed, constant wind. Are they worth the expense? I also have a 6 kilowatt off-grid solar panel to combine with the wind. So what's your honest opinion on that?
Okay. Wind and small levels, just not cost-effective. High outlay for a little gain. So even if you fed in 100%, you'd still be, with solar panels, you'd be way in front of wind. So we did an assessment of a school up north that had both solar panels and wind, and they queried the data because they're only made after their $30,000, $40,000 investment in the wind, they're only making $400 a year from it at one-to-one feed-in back then, compared to obviously big advantage on spend that money, you'd probably get $4,000 out of solar panels with a heavy feeding.
Something, I think that's answered that question, hasn't it? Yes,
yep.
Something that never seems to be mentioned. What's the lifespan of a solar panel, Carol?
It will vary. Australian solar scientist Stefan, can't think of his other name at the moment, ex-University of New South Wales solar department, was concerned about quality of panels. So he set up a model test in regards to the 25-year warranty to last to 80% of its performance and still be at 80% by year 25. Got the test validated by the world's proper scientist that was a fair test. Took 18 months. Couldn't test 700 brands, but took the best that you'd see in value out of the performance out of the Tier 3 cheaper panels. They all failed the pre-test. Tier 2s and 1 started failing for year 8 and 10. Some lasted years 28 and 32 before they dropped to 80%, so exceeded it. However, at that stage, they're about the same performance of cheap panels day one. So, you know, oils aren't oils.
So you get what you pay for, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or less, because of if you just get your money back or nearly get your money back and then limp along with low performance or, you've made a bad investment.
So as a consumer, how do you know, other than by price, because there's so many variables in that, how do you know that you're getting one that will exceed the standard, do that plus 25 years?
You do questions,
years?
You ask people, you narrow it down and find out who you can trust.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, let's move on, because we were a bit cryptic before about this technology, which you think could change the game completely. We're going to be joined now by Paul Wilson, who's the director of RVO, who is manufacturing this technology, John?
They've got other people manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got off the phone from big investors in the US for half an hour looking to invest in the manufacturing company in Dubai. Yep, so they hold the technology.
Yep. So, Paul, I'll say good morning for a start. It's Chris here, and John's listening as well. Paul?
Good morning, Chris.
Hello. I had a look at your YouTube video yesterday, and John's very keen that we talk to you. Batteries are the big thing. When we've done these talkbacks with John in the past, we've been inundated with questions about the viability of getting a battery storage, you know, solar panels on the roof, battery storage to use it at night, and the cost efficiency of that. What I'm understanding is that the system you've come up with would eliminate the lead acid battery as we know it altogether.
Yeah, that's right. My background is in energy storage systems on grid and off grid. So we deployed many lead acid batteries over many, many years. And we looked at moving to lithium batteries a few years ago and just couldn't work out. The economics didn't work, a little bit like the comment about the wind turbines, that they sound like a nice idea, but they don't always stack up. And so we looked at developing a supercapacitor instead of a chemical battery. So effectively, what we have now is an electro battery rather than electrochemical battery. So it's still a battery because it stores energy and charges and discharges. It just doesn't use a chemical reaction to do that.
Right, so it still stores energy. How does it do it?
So if you can imagine when you rub your hand on a balloon and then you put it on someone's hair, you get that static electricity. That's the energy storage on the surface of a material. So if you could get an enormous balloon, let's say 4 acres in size, the amount of electrons that you could store on the surface of that balloon is enormous. And so what the clever scientists have done is developed a product called graphene, which is a single atom layer of graphite, which is the things you use in your grade lead pencils. And they're able to extract this graphene from graphite and actually make an enormous surface area in a very small package. In fact, you know, a AA size battery,
yep,
the size of your finger. Inside one of these AA size cells, which is a supercapacitor cell, which is inside our module, there is 4 acres of surface area inside one the size of your finger.
Goodness.
And inside each package, there is either 1,200 or 2,400 of these cells. So you end up with 4,800 acres of surface area in a smaller one.
But using that balloon analogy, though, all that electricity discharges at one shock, one big go. How do you, because you want to, obviously...
That's half of the problem. Half of the problem is energy density, which came about by developing graphene. And the other part of it is actually energy management. So how do we actually charge and discharge these capacitors to make them think they're batteries? And I can't tell you how to, that we do that, but it works, because that's what the battery, that's what the device does. It looks like a battery to all the inverters. They think it's a battery. It behaves like a battery, but it doesn't have a chemical reaction inside it.
So it's a super capacitor, and yeah. They've been used, like if you have a three-phase pump or something like that, they've all got capacitors in them, haven't they? Because they store a bit of energy in there and help a big electrical switch, if you like, start.
All inverters are full of capacitors, so you should think about a power supply doesn't actually make power. It actually, a capacitor makes power. So all we're doing is taking the capacitors that are inside an inverter and actually getting highly dense ones and packaging them into a box. So we're moving away from having a chemical battery, which is like a bottleneck, into a graphene-based supercapacitor battery.
Yes, but when the whole world embracing batteries at the moment, and yet this technology comes along, which is something totally different. I mean, capacitors have been around for 100 years, but the way it's all been put together is totally different. Does that mean that the lead-acid battery, the lithium battery kind of storage, is now, well, potentially redundant?
It is. Well, it's just a matter of time now. So the economics are there now. If you look at the cost of a chemical battery, we have a thing called cost per kilowatt-hour life, where we look at the cost for the battery, we divide it by the number of times it can give you a kilowatt-hour and then give it back to you before it dies. And they have a price for each unit. So a lead battery might be 13, 14, 15 cents for every time it stores an energy unit and gives it back to you by the time it dies. And a lithium-ion battery, depending on the brand, might be 12, 15 cents, 18 cents, 25 cents, depending on the brand.
Forgive me just interrupting there. I did a maths on a spreadsheet last night.
Yep.
Allowing for the fact that you would store, say, a typical 12 kilowatt-hour commonly used lithium-ion battery at the moment, and there's 5,000 cycles, one a day, that's 13.7 years, but the expected payback period is 15 years, given that you avoid feed-in of 9 cents credit in Tassie, therefore you're getting 17 cents value for each kilowatt outcome back on tariff, our tariff 31 lights and power, so you don't get your money back even.
Yeah. So the difference between that and a supercapacitor is a supercapacitor can do a million charge cycles. Because there's no chemical reaction, it's electrostatic storage. The energy can flow into the capacitor and out of the capacitor.
So it would last forever, basically.
And we worked out to be 2,300 years.
It'll see me out.
It should just see you out.
Yeah.
But the reality is that the electronics inside it won't last that long. So we estimate about a 45-year design life for the technology with a small amount of maintenance. And if we divide that into the number of cycles we can get, we work out that we're around about 1/6 of 1 cent per kilowatt hour life.
Yes.
Which I think 110 times better than a Tesla Powerwall.
Crikey. Paul, we're going to have to press on. It's a bit of a tease to start talking about this kind of technology and move on, but we've got plenty of callers and plenty of texts we really should be getting through. But is it one of those things where I'm hearing about this for the first time, this kind of technology, there's going to be this, I'll just wait and see. I'm waiting and seeing for two reasons. A, that it's proved, and B, because the prices always come down if you wait a bit longer. So where are we at in that cycle?
Oh, it's a little bit dearer than a lithium battery for the same storage, but if you look at the life of it, it's extremely cheap.
Mm.
So it's kind of like arguing that I should buy a diesel car or a petrol car. It depends on how far you drive it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we already have around about 30 or 40 installers around the country who have already changed across to start to use supercapacitors instead of lead batteries because they don't like selling a chemical battery, which is probably going to fail fairly soon in their eyes. And also has the risk of fire and gassing, depending on the technology, whereas the capacitor doesn't have that risk.
Yes.
So you have a known risk with a chemical battery, which is failure and fire, whereas a supercapacitor has no known risk. So you're actually in a much better position.
Paul, we're going to press on, but thank you for taking the call, and we'll obviously talk a bit more about this once we let you go. But Paul Wilson, Director of RVO, behind the supercapacitor battery, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good day. Thank you, Paul. And, John, that's all interesting stuff, isn't it? You've got to be a little bit, you know, Paul would say that because that's the product that they're selling as well. Because I must admit, I don't think of batteries as being particularly hazardous, the ones that people are installing domestically. I mean, obviously, I'm speaking, I don't have any personal experience of those. But you stand back. I mean, you're a retailer of these things. Yes. You don't have an interest in this. But do you think this is exciting technology?
Well, I have an interest, but I have been telling people, don't buy batteries, panel up, until now the game's changed. Because if you're simply putting in a battery to nearly get your money back or just get your money back, it's not a good investment. The numbers aren't there for lithium ion technology, but this is a game changer in the fact that it it uses that graphene, a sheet of paper rolled up tight with an aluminium case. So, you know, environmentally, we're using carbon and paper.
Yeah, and last word on these, unless listeners have got questions, but are we seeing them come into Tasmania? Because this technology isn't speculation. It's available now.
The first unit on that video came into Victoria for the December conference, and they that was the first unit of the arrival, and they had to sell 200 to Victorians first to meet the Victorian government's input backing it. They've done that, and now they're taking orders and wanting orders from me to say, right, give us your orders. And
we haven't seen one in Tasmania yet, though.
No.
But we could do if you wanted to. If somebody ordered one tomorrow, you could do it.
Well, there's a time frame to get it, because obviously there's going to be a waiting list now. It's a bit like when the breakthrough on LED TV came out, and they met that very cheap price of $9,999 instead of $20,000 odd.
Yes.
And there was a run on them.
Yeah. Now you can get them for about $300, yeah.
Well, there were six, but...
Yeah. There's a text here, no name to it, but it says, I understand that graphene is a way off commercial scale development. Do you have any ideas of the time frame? Well, it's here now, isn't it?
Well, it's here. Basically, I'd be thinking to invest in graphene in the early stages. Like Warren Buffett, here's a go. Warren Buffett invested in a company called BYD in China 10 years ago, who were making lithium batteries for phones and looking to get into cars. So he looked next to where he puts his keys every morning and found $230 million lying around in loose change and put it into the company. That's tenfold return now. It's a factory that has 60% more production than Tesla.
Fair dinkum. This is the graphene, the supercapacitor.
No, so this is lithium ion.
Oh, lithium ion. Okay.
And there's no employees. They dig it out and put it through from one end to the other, pop a battery out every few seconds with no employees. And, if you wouldn't be investing in lithium ion now, would you? It's just like, well, let's invest in VHS tapes,
All right, we're getting way off topic, but it's food for thought. And I know you're finding it astonishing, and I found it pretty astonishing as well. So have a look at supercapacitor technology as a form of energy storage. Now, let's move on to more domestic things. I'm considering, this is from Anna, I'm back to your heat pumps, I'm considering a heat pump ducted under the floor with floor vents. How does that compare to a wall-mounted unit? And access is not a problem, as there is a garage under the house. So what's the options here? A heat pump ducted under the floor with vents as compared to a wall-mounted unit?
We sell a lot of ducted systems, a lot more split systems. Obviously, price points are different. So
a split system is a wall-mounted system?
Well, they're all split. We call them ducted. So a split system is half the units inside, half outside. A multi-split where you've got multiple heads inside and one unit outside.
Okay,
so a ducted has the head unit, if you like, in the ceiling or under the floor and run ducts to deliver it to each room.
Yep.
And then a return air section, typically in the hallway, that takes the air back and puts it through to be heated up and recirculate again. So, look, ducted's most popular for cooling because you need to push cooling into each room to cool your bedrooms and so forth and so on. Whereas heat travels differently. So we find it depends on the individual situation. A ducted system, decent one for an average 20-odd square house, might be around $12,000,
$13,000. That's deducted in every room in the house, yeah?
Yep. One unit. And you typically, high wall units, that's about 16 kilowatts or so. And you can get more bang for your buck for less money in high walls, so you can
But you don't get the circulation through the house, though, do you?
Well, with a high wall unit, for instance, a single split, if you present it to the main living area, your hallways are big ducts. You know, you don't have to install already there. Cold air's heavy and falls back, like a sea breeze or like pouring water out on the floor, will fall back in and push warm air out and recirculate it back into those bedrooms. As long as you don't knock it off on the pathway by leaving your bathroom, toilet and laundry doors open, where you've got vents, ceiling holes with fans, which is a bit like leaving your window open. So generally, most houses are satisfied with an oversized unit in the main living area to then allow to take a chill off the bedrooms, but they don't cool bedrooms. So cooling is different. You get that thermal mass in the bedrooms.
But you're saying if you leave doors open, obviously not your bathroom doors or whatever, that heat should spread throughout the house.
The cold will fall back and breeze back in and push the warm air out. Because heat pumps, basically, like a high wall head, it'll push off 55 degrees, generally maximum temperature, hit the floor at 35 in the primary heat zone down between you and the telly, say, and then evenly mix through that room. So you haven't got this humongous amount of heat around the ceiling like other heating sources. So it creates this gentle flow and gentle draft that pushes the warm air back up into the bedrooms to a reasonable level. But having said that, obviously, it's a matter of choice. You get that direct into the bedroom effect. You could have...
With the ducting you're talking
with
about.
With the ducting. Or you could have small single heads in each bedroom.
Mm. Mm.
Or one in the hallway and one in the lounge.
It's a neater installation, underfloor ducting, I think.
I prefer ceiling because underfloor you cut a vent in, it's there and you have timber or wherever. You know, it's might be in the wrong spot when you move furniture and so forth.
Okay.
So I generally prefer ceiling outlets.
Okay. All right. I hope that answers your question, Anna. We've got John Thurgood in the studio. We're talking alternative energy. And, John, we talked for too long before and all our callers hung up on us. And sorry about that. So give us a call back on 1300 222 936. It's 27 past 10. Tony, you're talking to John. Morning, Tony.
How you going, John? How you going, Chris?
Morning, Tony.
I just want to add something to that super capacitor.
Sure.
Issue yesterday. I just looked up on the internet. The UK's been developing that technology for a while, and they've put testing in trucks and all that sort of stuff. They were already making batteries and everything like that. It's been going ahead for a fair while.
I saw where the capacitor was patents first start popping up in 1883 or something like that.
That's right.
Noted just a couple of years ago the Australian Institute of Engineers or something like that were noting the downfalls and the shortfalls in capacitors used as batteries. So the evolution here is fine-tuning it to make it extremely viable over a longer period. And as the technology will actually, like the 7-kilowatt storage battery will take 7 kilowatts in 30 seconds, but they drag it out for 30 minutes so you don't have a welder. And then you can 100% cycle in and cycle out from that using up to 7 kilowatts full draw load from that battery, and then do that a million times, or as I said, perhaps only a lousy 45 years life compared to... Shortfalls for the others.
Yep. Anyway,
what they're doing is they're using it as a regenerative braking energy source and everything. Trains, trucks. That's where they're looking at putting that technology.
Yeah, and Formula One's been using that for a while.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they're doing. It's got a quick charge, and then they use it to go back up the other hill. That's the ideal thing. That's what they've been doing with it. Like it says in China, it's even doing it with their railways, regenerative braking, so they can use. Anyway, we'll get off that.
Yep.
I wanted to wonder why biogas is not put on the books as a better idea with a lot of places, especially towns and communities and all that sort of stuff, because we've already got all the stuff here to produce biogas, and they've been doing it in other parts of the world with some of the generating stations are massive in America and all sorts of places, because it's just all complete green energy in it, and it just benefits the atmosphere. It's got all the pluses that like you wouldn't believe, but... we've got all these places in Tasmania where they could put some of these sites to actually make a fortune out of it. No one, I don't know what's going on.
And it's not a question I've ever heard asked either in Tasmania.
No, that's the thing. Yeah, have a look on the internet. It's really what they're doing around the world.
Yeah,
and we've got all our water storage. We've got our free batteries there already. So why are we buying batteries if we've got a decent feed-in tariff? We wouldn't need them. So we wouldn't need to duplicate costs and waste energy buying individual little batteries. We just use the big one we've already got. So we're still working on a fair feed-in tariff. We're getting a wholesale rate. Plus line losses without delivery at 9 cents, or 8.929. But delivery is about 12 cents, and we think we avoid most of that by going next door to the neighbours. And we're still pushing this, and we have got some traction, but we haven't got a result. I was hopeful we might get something in the election to help someone get over the line, but they thought they'd get there anyway, perhaps.
Specifically by...
What was this with the biogas you're talking about?
No. He's feeding tariff.
He's just having... I think Baslin came into that somehow too. But biogas, John, is anybody in Australia? Are there any biogas generators in Tasmania?
Yeah, there are.
Not my area. I mean, I look mainstream. We're looking for general populace and population. And I guess the cream of ease of use and manufacturing prominence that develops where the first solar panel is probably $10,000. Is now, you know, three for $1,000 or something, or four. It's all about numbers and results and convenience and so forth. So.
And does it have to be on a large scale? Could you do a small scale biomass generator?
Yeah, you can do that. In third world countries, like everyone's got their own, everyone makes their own little biogas unit to run their stave and sort of stuff like that. But in places like it's farms over the mainland that's got used biogas. So I got these. Yeah. You can buy a portable generator, like it's like the size of a container, and they've already got all the farms and all that sort of stuff, which produce all the proper stuff to make all the gas. And you run generators, and if you have a look at what they produce out of that, like a lot of these farms, because what it all gets down to is, let's say, for argument's sake, the feedlock down the middle of Zoe had a decent sized one. Everything's just set up there perfectly for it. All your input costs are virtually not much because you're just value-adding what you've already got.
So it
reduces the cost of electricity because everyone's just producing... They're making standalone... Well, like a lot of countries in the United States and councils and all, they're all getting biogas because it's all clean, green, enemy, cleans up the atmosphere. It does everything you want, but at the end of the day, it reduces the cost. So you don't have to go to all these other high technologies, which might cost a bit more money, so people can we can use a better energy source.
Yeah. Tony, it's food for thought, isn't it? And I've never heard of, I'm already planning on, we should do a bit more about that too, maybe even on a Sunday program. John, have you ever had an inquiry about a biogas generator?
Well, we have a customer who was looking at a 100-kilowatt system that decided he would, on along some lines, burn his waste to generate energy. However, I'm not sure that in the end was a good decision when you got laminates and so forth and so on. But
The problem with landfill generators is they're not as effective, wouldn't be effective as something like a feedlot where it's got the pure waste which has got going to produce a gas. Mm. And the methane goes in the atmosphere anyway, which causes global warming. Even farmers even grow crops because the thing is, it's what you put into the thing. If you have a look on YouTube, you'll fall over when you see it. The technology that's getting around in places like United States and Britain and all those places, it's just...
Well, it's great stuff. It fits a certain area, but it's not mainstream for Mrs. Suburbia.
Yeah.
No, if you want to make
industrial.
Yeah. Tony, we're going to have to press on because we've got a huge bank of callers, but it really is food for thought. Thank you very much for that. We just got a severe weather warning from Tasmania Police. Damaging winds have been forecast. This was issued just minutes ago. Damaging winds for all of Tasmania, King Island, the Furneaux Islands, Western, Up and Derwent Valley, Southeast, Northeast, East Coast, Northwest Coast, the Central North, Central Plateau, Midlands forecast districts. Damaging winds are expected for all of Tasmania later today, early tomorrow and also early on Monday as two vigorous cold fronts are set to cross Tasmania. So a severe weather warning just been issued by Tasmania Police just minutes ago.
Turn over your trampolines and put some cement bags on.
good for your wind generator. We've got an absolute stack of texts. We'll just take a few calls first. Margaret is in Elizabethtown. Good morning, Margaret. Hello, Margaret. Margaret, I'll put you on hold just in case you're coming to the phone, and we'll say good morning to Talia at St. Leonard's. Good morning, Talia.
Good morning. I just have a question about the two different types of solar battery storage systems. I've been looking at the Tesla Powerwall 2 and also the Redback Technologies smart hybrid battery enclosure. Mm. I'm wondering if you're familiar with them and if you could direct me as to the preferential one to choose.
Well, basically, I'd be pointing towards supercapacitors.
Okay. And whereabouts would I be able to find out about those? From you or another store?
Yes. Well, from me, yes. Others, I would think, yes, they'd want to jump on. I guess I don't know if anybody else has
yet. This is technology that's only just arriving in Australia by the sound of it, the supercapacitor. Yeah.
Right,
but, John could be a good port of call, but there'll be others. We've got to watch our commercial considerations here, being in the ABC.
Correct.
Yeah. But I'm just wondering, would they be available now to install?
Soon. Stocks are coming through. Like, so the first unit landed in Australia, and in accommodation set up with the battery, the controller, the whole box and dice, which is either on-grid or off-grid, doesn't care, no blackout problems, lots of advantages in the technology, and a combination of three Victorian companies putting together their technologies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, then. So over winter or...
Well, one's got to consider, see, even these batteries you could store back from the grid on off-peak, like a time of use. You've got to look at the numbers. I haven't done that yet succinctly, but you get your energy source in from solar, say, and or even off-peak rates. The Brenny Island project, I think, was a little bit premature, you know, with all that cost put in. If you look at cutting energy, shifting energy cost, such as all the hot water cylinders recharging, not at the same time you put on your toaster and kettle, shift it off a few hours with a simple timer, and then look at battery that can take in energy on low load periods in off-peak costs and push that back in it to offset 26 cents value in peak times. So that can ease problems on the grid. And obviously couple with solar panels where you make your own and store your own. So if you're storing your own, bear in mind you're offsetting 26 cents, unless you're commercial, then it's lower because of the GST claim back. But 26 cents, then take off what you would have got for a credit for feed-in of 8.929, you get about 17 cents offset going into your battery and coming back. So you've got to look at your payback period at 17 cents. So I did that on 5,000 cycles on the your Tesla and other similar batteries, Samsung and BYD. And it shows 13.7 years of clawback of price, but it takes you 15 years to pay back. So it's short on the payback period just to break even.
We lost Talia in the middle of all that, but I assume she was probably listening as well. I don't know why, but somebody's taken us to task about whether that's the Bureau or Tasmania Police issuing that severe weather warning. Tasmania Police has posted that new community alert, a severe weather warning. Damaging winds expected for all of Tasmania later today, early tomorrow and early on Monday as two vigorous cold fronts are set to cross Tasmania. Go and have a look at your Tasmania Police webpage, a new community alert, that severe weather warning. Now, there's biogas at the Hobart tip, says Stuart. A biogas generator there?
Yeah, one system. Yep.
Okay.
They're just tapping into the gas from composting underneath.
Yeah, sure. This is an interesting question. Is there heat lost through a ducted range hood, like you have over your hot plates, while it's not operating? How can it be reduced or prevented? John?
Okay. Convection will see heat rise, and it can escape through there, the range hood, any other ventilation systems, like the little vents on your walls in older homes where they were placed there for a couple of reasons. If you had a wood fire, to relieve the noxious fumes at the higher level and vent out, or to equalise and control moisture problems and mould where you didn't really have effective heatings, you know, open fire situations and so forth. So older homes, you can look on a wall and see straight through to clean air on some of these vents. Look, your range hood isn't that, you know, you don't have to get over pedantic in every area. Certainly, if you left the thing running at a high volume one, you're going to suck that air out and heat with it, but everything in balance.
Let's take another call. This is Margaret in Elizabethtown. I think we got you this time, Margaret. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I was just wondering, we have a Daikin inverter. It's been in for 14 years now, and it's mounted in the wall where the fireplace used to be, up off the ground.
Okay.
Are they more as heat efficient as the wall-mounted one up, you know, near the ceiling or not?
Right. They're both high-wall units, I think you're talking about. There is
no,
also a floor-mounted unit. You're talking about a floor-mounted unit.
It's square.
Yeah, floor-mount or high-wall.
Yes.
Here's a pet favourite of mine. In the early days, I noted that down south here there was a high proliferation of floor-mounts where I kind of backed in Julius Sumner Miller, professor, and saying, well, hot air rises, so don't put it on the floor and point half of it, all of it up. So the early models were under-ceiling units turned on their side, so they sucked in the bottom and blew out the top. Now, you wouldn't buy an electric heater that did that.
No.
Right, so causing draft, air coming across the floor, evaporating off your skin at 19 degrees will feel like 15 or 16. The newer models will push half out the top and half out the bottom, so you've still got this problem, but also the air's got to come back in to push out. So that's coming in the sides, which can also form a draft. Now, a lot of customers who buy floor mounts from me that disagree, it's comfortable, I love it, fine. But in essence, the high wall will push it, you angle it to the floor, push it down to the floor, get into the cold air and mix it, and the return air comes across the ceiling. So you've got a nice separation of flow of incoming cooler air, coming out as hot air, just where you want it, down on the floor, getting into that cold air and converting it into warm so you don't get cold feet or drafts.
Right. Which is the more efficient cost-wise? Or are they both the same?
Yeah. In the same size, they're both the same. I'll give you an idea. The particular brand you might be talking of, the newer models, about 33% cheaper to run, using 2.02 kilowatts for an 8-kilowatt input, putting out 8 to 10 kilowatts of heat. And
right.
Just using that energy to steal free heat from outside and bring it inside.
Right. And what would a new one cost now?
Oh, we're talking probably like, okay, the floor mount's going to cost you about $1,000 more than the high wall, about, you know, installed about 3.3, 3.6, depending on your installation, where it is and how long the pipe runs are. You're paying $1,000 more for the floor mount because it's probably only 1% or 0.5% of the world market turnover. And when you look at that company that's got $2.45 billion turnover in air conditioning worldwide, very small percent. It's a bit like the old days, getting back to VHS tapes. If you bought a three-hour one for $3, but if you wanted a half-hour one, it'd probably cost you $5. So it's all about volumes, and the floor mounts are a lower volume. They do suit applications. As a matter of fact, I'm creating this new display, but I've done it about 6 times out of about 10,000 I've sold, putting a high wall on the floor. Sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? But you put the high wall on the floor or underneath the bench so you don't see in the ugly top part. But further than that, I said, well, I'll box it in with some boxing, make it look like a fireplace, hide it, run it off the app on the smartphone, put the new misting fake fire, won't name the brand, that looks like a fire, but and LED lights cost nothing to run, really. And there's your mental, psychological fire.
Does it heat the room, though?
And it heats the room because it uses the heat pump to heat it. It pushes the heat out across the floor and draws it in from the top near the ceiling through a gap in your enclosure. And then you put a little recess for your TV in it and a wine rack and coffee machine, whatever you like.
Because that's part of the problem is they're pretty ugly, aren't they, when they're hanging on the wall?
Well, I think they're beautiful.
All right, Margaret, I hope that answered your question. Thank you very much for that. John Thurgood in the studio. It's 13 minutes to 11 o'clock. John Thurgood in the studio talking alternative energy for another 12 minutes or so. Paul's given us a call from Sheffield. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, good morning. Listen, just really quick. You're talking about those graphite superconductor. How do I find them on the internet, please?
Right. I've got it on my website, if you know the name of the business. I shouldn't mention on here.
No.
And you look up the company Vimeo, and they've got YouTube videos there where Paul is explaining at the conference in December.
What is it? VEO.
No, it's ARVIO, isn't it? ARVIO.
ARVIO.
IO. Sorry, that's right. Yep. I'm still getting my head around the.
Yeah. All right, so you just do that on
that
YouTube.
I'm still getting my head around the name.
Yeah, have a look on that on YouTube, and you'll find it there.
Thank
yeah.
you very much indeed.
Good. Bye-bye.
Bye bye.
See you. Bye bye, Paul. Speaking of supercapacitors, are they compatible with the current solar panel and inverter setup?
Yes. I've done some initial data and spreadsheets the other night, working through that. They are certainly compatible with anything. So it's a, you can buy it in a complete box, which is the way we really look at doing it, where it's just a plug and play. It's on 600 kilo casters by four. So you can wheel across your driveway, tow it with your car almost, I think. It's in a box about, I don't know, 5 foot high and...
And the point there is obviously it's portable.
And it just plugs in. So you can take it to your nest house and plug it in there as well. So you can plug it into an existing house system. I said you don't necessarily even need solar if you're going to recover off peak, or farmers might want to, can keep some equipment continually going. And basically those sort of applications too.
I think Carol's making a valid point here. All these ways to make electricity make Aurora look very cheap.
Yeah, well, we've got a cost-effective system we all own, and it's very competitive nationally. However, you know, prices have gone up. We gold-plated the poles and wires, as we said, and prices doubled in 10 years. And, you know, I was selling those first oil-filled column heaters back in the early 70s at Keynes in New Norfolk, I think. You know, it was 2 cents a kilowatt hour. Off-peak heaters, you know, cheap to run. Now we're looking at off-peak at about 11 cents, but not cost-effective to get heat pumps on the 17-cent tariff and 26 cents for power. So, and we have some people on contracts out there up to 41 cents a kilowatt hour for commercial on these contested contracts where they're recontracting for 3 years. And, for instance, last year this particular operation got hit with their new contract, 41 cents because of the lack of power with coal fire changing down, the danger of lack of energy. The following year, 36 cents, and the following year, 26, as they see more solar farms come on stream. It's about the third biggest cost of business, or fourth in businesses, and it's about the only cost you can do anything with. And like a 100 kilowatt system on a business that might relieve, depending on the feed-in level, might relieve $25,000 to $35,000 off a power bill and pay for itself within 3 to 5 years.
It's a matter of doing the maths and making the commitment, isn't it?
It's 25% to 33% ROIs.
Okay, look, we've only got 9 minutes left, and there's a few here I want you to just have your thoughts on. We're considering putting in a hydroponic heating in our triple brick. It's a double-storey 1850s house. What are your thoughts?
Hydroponic heating?
Yeah, it's not hydroponic. Hydronic.
That's where the real heat pump is, heating water. So you heat water with an outdoor unit, or you can use a geothermal unit.
And the water is then circulated around radiators like had in Europe for years. Yeah.
Just not that hot, so they're bigger radiator, more surface area, because you've got a lower temperature to distribute, and they work on cooling as well. Very expensive to put in.
Because of all the plumbing, you mean?
Yeah, all the manual plumbing starts to come into it. So, look, it's we have done some current quotes. I haven't heard back from a few people because the shock of, we have put in a few systems. It's a beautiful sort of convected heat, of course, where people don't want air moving.
Be easier to install it when you're building, wouldn't it, rather than retro-install?
I put it in the extension of a slab in a home, 10 years ago that we had, and that was it just permeates through the slab. You don't need your Fikari, to keep your feet warm. You can go straight on the tiles with your bare feet and set it for, and it just permeates through the slab. And a bit like underfloor electric heating without the cost.
So you think it's a great thing, and it would work on a triple brick, double-storey 1850s house, but the retrofitting would be challenging,
correct.
I imagine.
It all works. It's not as cheap to run as, the inverters, air source heaters. And more expensive to put in. So it's selected use.
Okay. Where'd it go? Somebody was asking about cleaning. Oh, I think it's skipped over to the other page. We get our texts on a computer screen here, and as they come in, they sort of, you know, scroll down. You've got to keep chasing them. Solar panels need cleaning. What do you think about a wiper blade system, not unlike a car, accompanied with the installation?
Well, there are people that have developed things. I've had on a local rep say, the iRobot guys that do the vacuum cleaners and have these little things run across your panels and clean them. Oh, I haven't seen that come through yet. I mean, basically, you can clean them this week and they could be dirty next week again, although there's build-up of general grime. With most A-grade panels, it's self-cleaning process. They've got a treatment to the glass. So morning dew, rain, all that sort of thing, wash them clear. A case model, 4 years old, systems haven't been washed
yet. So to cut to the chase, cleaning it with a squeegee thing? What do you think?
Just use a mop with, I converted the mop end on a long painter's pole.
Okay, yeah.
Right, 3 metres reach, but you've got to change the end over because they're different ends, tape it all straight. Yeah. You fix that, then you wrap it in some sponges to get that volume water holding and some microfiber cloths and a few cable ties, dip it in your bucket of car wash, whatever, and run them over the panels, hose them off first, do that, hose them off afterwards.
But you would do that as a regular bit of maintenance, would you?
Yeah, or not do it at all.
All right. Why don't we use ground transfer heat pumps instead of air?
Right. I got into that very early on. We didn't actually end up selling one. You've got to dig geothermal. Four or eight holes with a digger down 30 metres or 70. Or in England, you've seen them in the programs, so they dig up your whole yard and put them a metre deep.
Yeah, but about 40 metres of it, though. Yeah.
And, basically expensive. It gets into that thermal mass down there where you've got that constant temperature. But in Tassie, we're not in the extremes of minus 40s and 20s and, you know, beautiful for air source heat pumps here.
Yeah, okay. Dave here, does a ducted system in the ceiling from a high mount heat pump work on delivering cold air to bedrooms, or does it only transfer heat effectively? Can you follow that?
Slight confusion. Well, a high wall heat pump is a high wall heat pump. A ducted system is pretend you grab that thing and take the covers off it, whack it in your ceiling, and get the air coming in the back from a duct work from, say, your return air spot in your hallway with a big duct, a couple of ducts.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the outside, you put ductwork on that end to deliver it into each room space. So you've got it enclosed then and delivering to each room, and you've got different sized ducts and different more outlets in living areas and one in the bedroom. Therefore, it balances the flow and gives you the appropriate delivery in each room for heating or cooling. So it's heating or cooling, reverse cycle.
Knowing solar panels are made with some toxic materials, I don't trust them for drinking water from the roof. If they get damaged without us knowing, that could be a problem, Joy.
Wouldn't say, like, it's like your car windscreen. So if it gets damaged, it'll go off like those little squares. I popped one once when I put it.
But what about the toxic materials they're made of with your drinking water?
Well, it's glass with an aluminium and the underneath covering sheet plastic. Don't see any issues. You probably got more issues from possums or anything else flying over, dropping things.
Yes.
Or the paint on your roof going off. Yeah, no. I mean, put filters on to be safe for drinking water from your roof.
We have a ceiling duct. How is the best way to clean it? I live near the road and it's quite dusty, Carolyn.
A ceiling duct.
Yeah.
Basically, there's covers on whether it's ceiling fans or anything else that come off. And the horrible ones have got those little, you know, little ribs everywhere that gather dust and always look ugly. And you can usually twist them sideways like a BC light globe batten and get them off or clip them off and wash them. Incidentally, there is my favourite fan works about 12 times better than any of standard ceiling fan. And it has blades with no cover, and the blades are weighted. When you turn the fan on, they throw open, and when you turn the fan off, they close. So it'll stop flies and things coming in pretty well and cut the draft. And so they're a nice, neat unit. And you can take the whole thing off and wash it, the blade section as well. There you go.
It's 3 minutes to 11 o'clock. And keep an eye on the time because this is the kind of question you love, John Thurgood. Any thoughts on using the single tariff 93 with solar?
Time of use. I'm using time of use for my own installation I've just put in, 42 kilowatts, for semi-commercial, a couple of apartments and a retail building. And we're 18 hours a day. It's off-peak, and on-peak is in naturally those peak periods, and then all weekends off-peak. So I see the benefit there. I originally did the data on time of use for homes, and it looked to me, well, particularly when you draw in hot water, it basically added 60% to your power bill. So you've got to be careful here, and consider that. So solar on tariff 93 compared to 30.
On using single tariff 93 with solar.
Yeah, you'll offset your power and you'll get the same feed-in credit. You've got to do the numbers on whether the value's in that or the value's in your current tariff, hot water and heating tariff and tariff 31 lights and power.
It's the kind of challenge you love, I know. Yeah. And look, you're down to your last 1 minute. So is there any advantage, this is from Annie, in turning off my heat pump at night or when I go away?
No. I ran a case study myself in a little building at La Nina. We have renovated up and basically 8-kilowatt unit running 24-7 at 21 degrees, June, July, August, year before last. Three nights I turned it down to 19 because it got too warm in the bedroom. The rest were clear and minus in the morning, and leave it on all day because you're stealing heat 15 times cheaper virtually. So that cost $348 for 3 months, 24-7. The following year, last year, the power price went up halfway through. It cost $345, but it was on average, had to turn it down 50% of the time to 19 overnight. So run them 24-7, don't turn them down, don't turn them off. Keep the temperature up. Don't go down below 19, please.
John Thurgood, there's always a lot to absorb whenever you come on the wireless. And I dare say there's a lot of people scratching their heads, but it gives them food for thought and they'll go and do their own research as well. So Correct. It's much appreciated. You make a big effort to be here. So we do appreciate it, John Thurgood. Brilliant. We'll do it again soon.